This is part 15 of Your Life is Their Toy, Merchants in Medicine by Dr. Emanuel Josephson from 1948. Diploma mills multiply. The situation in medical education in New York was characteristic of the situation in other sections of the country. The large incomes of quote-unquote professors tempted doctors to start new medical schools to amplify their otherwise meager incomes. Those physicians who succeeded in getting into the medical, quote-unquote, education racket sought to make a monopoly of the business and to keep out rivals. The dawn of the era of, quote-unquote, big business discovered medical leaders launching upon, quote-unquote, big business in medicine. In the last decades of the 19th century and in the early decades of the present century, medical schools grew like mushrooms overnight in all sections of the country. In these schools, classes containing as high as 200 to 300 or more students were not at all unusual. Teaching was conducted on a lecture and quiz basis. The vogue was then established, which still persists in medical education. The art of medicine, upon which human lives depend, is made the subject of rote learning and dependent upon the chances of examination. There was no valid effort to make sure that these future practitioners had mastered the skill and the knowledge necessary for the protection of the lives of their patients. These schools were highly successful, however, in building up enormous practices and incomes for their medical bosses. A further step in the development of the medical education racket was the quote-unquote diploma mill. These institutions gave concrete expression to the obvious fact that attendance in crowded classes to hear lectures on diseases and their remedies is of no value in the learning of the art of the practice of medicine. Facing the situation with greater candor than their competitors, the schools issued medical diplomas to applicants who were willing to pay the price without requiring that the applicant even attend the school. It is seriously to be questioned whether these diploma mills did not turn out greater physicians than did their competitors. Thus, the Rush Medical College of Chicago gave a degree to George H. Simmons while he was practicing as an advertising quack many miles away in Lincoln, Nebraska. It thus supplied the medical profession with the man who revitalized its august and authoritative AMA. Medical education and the Rockefellers. Competition became extremely keen in this medical school business. As a consequence, the overlords of medicine found that they were not gaining the full advantage which they had hoped from their medical schools. They thereupon set about establishing a monopoly of the medical school business by wiping out their competitors. The merchants in medicine organized in the AMA found allies in their fellow merchants in industry at the beginning of this century. It is peculiarly fitting that the agency that enabled them to monopolize the field of medicine and its education should be the General Education Board, an outgrowth of Doc William Rockefeller's quack cancer cure and medicine show. A joint investigation into the medical schools of the country by Abraham Flexner was instituted about 1910. There ensued a publicity campaign of calumny and slander directed against medical schools in which the socially elect political bosses of medicine had no interests. The competing schools were represented as low grade and inferior. While it is true that the standards of some of them were low, few were lower in caliber than many of the schools which were sponsored by the bosses and investigators and approved for that reason. Over half of the 165 medical schools in the country were forced to close their doors. The balance of the medical schools were left in monopolistic control of medical education. This maneuver left the remaining schools under heavy debt to the Rockefeller Group and their General Education Board. By judicious subsidy, this debt has been converted to a highly profitable, dictatorial control of the medical schools of the country by the Rockefellers and allied financial interests, and by subsidiary social service groups. Medical education perverted to propaganda. This control of medical education and research has brought large dividends for the relatively minor funds invested. Among these dividends are the tangible items, allaying of public resentment and antagonism, and public goodwill gained through proper publicizing of these virtuous activities. The earning of goodwill through provision of comfortable berths, professorships, research positions, and others for dependents of folks of influence or of associates. Quite as important, if not more so, the power to eliminate individuals or groups of individuals who insist upon telling the truth as they see it, and thereby jeopardize the monetary interests of these powers. By alliance with religious institutions and missions abroad, they were enabled to penetrate and gain the goodwill of foreign lands for the furtherance of trade, commerce, and oil. Some of the dividends, however, were more tangible and far exceeded the value of the supposed philanthropies. Among these were the control and manipulation of the vast funds and endowments of the schools and universities, profits derived from licit and illicit enterprises such as the milk racket, the drug monopoly, and oil concessions, which were given prestige by the support of the prostituted institutions and their professors, and a very profitable control of medical and allied businesses. It has also enabled the group who control the foundation and other Rockefeller agencies to plant in universities as professors propagandists who serve their interests. Thus, the foundation has endowed the Institute of the History of Medicine of Johns Hopkins University, at the head of which has been placed the German propagandist of the Bismarckian program of socialized medicine and compulsory health insurance, Professor Henry E. Sigarist. With Professor C.E.A. Winslow, he has been one of the most active agitators for the program, which is so eagerly desired by the German Die Trust and their Rockefeller allies. From the subsidized group of professors, there was recruited the quote-unquote Committee of 430. It is not a matter of chance that some of the professors are leaders of communist propaganda. Thus, Dr. A.E. Blumberg of Johns Hopkins University has been cited by the Dies Committee as the secretary of the District of Columbia, Maryland branch of the Communist Party. Professor Franz D. Boas of Columbia University is reported by Walter Winchell to be the head of the communist cabal organized to discredit John Edgar Hoover and the FBI. His son, Dr. Ernest Boas, assistant professor of clinical medicine of the College of Physicians and Surgeons, Columbia University, leads the pseudo-liberal element in the medical profession of New York in its campaign for the adoption of socialized medicine and is a prominent leader in organized social service. These professors have organized an intensive campaign of propaganda which follows closely the party line of the Bismarckian or Commune Nazi dogma. They do this with the support of the organized social service and with the aid of subsidies from pseudo-philanthropies and of associated commercial interests under the auspices of an advisory board consisting of members of the Committee of 430, there is issued, as a vehicle of propaganda among medical students, a monthly magazine, the Journal of the Association of Medical Students, which is distributed free of charge to the students. On the advisory board of the journal are the following: Charles Sumner Bacon, M.D., University of Illinois; Emmett Bay, M.D., Rush Medical College; Hugh Cabot, M.D., University of Minnesota; Walter B. Cannon, M.D., Harvard; A.J. Carlson, M.D., Rush Medical College; Lewis A. Connor, M.D., American Heart Journal; David J. Davis, M.D., University of Illinois; Reginald Fitz, M.D., Boston University; J.F. Fulton, M.D., Yale University; Harold Edward McMahon, M.D., Tufts College; James H. Means, M.D., Harvard; Adolph Meyer, M.D., Johns Hopkins University; Joseph Earl Moore, M.D., Johns Hopkins; Harry S. Mustard, M.D., New York University; Thomas Perrin, M.D., U.S. Public Health Service; John P. Peters, M.D., Yale; G. Canby Robinson, M.D., Johns Hopkins; Martha Tracy, M.D., Women's Medical College of Pennsylvania; Maurice B. Vicker, M.D., University of Minnesota; C.E.A. Winslow, D.P.H., Yale University; George B. Wislocki, M.D., Harvard. Quote-unquote endowments and medical education costs. The medical school business under such control has become a highly lucrative business in more than one way. The greater the investments, or quote-unquote endowments, of the medical schools have become, the higher are the tuition fees demanded of the individual medical students. Tuition fees in medicine range as high as $700. The greater the sums contributed for, quote, the improvement of medical education, unquote, the higher has become its cost to the student. There is also the highly endowed medical schools, little of the altruism which they demand of their students. They are becoming increasingly purely commercial institutions bent on charging all that the traffic will bear. Sounds like today's colleges, all around. Monopoly of medical education and of the practice of medicine is now, as it always has been, the goal of these organizations and their cliques. The number of students admitted to the medical schools has been steadily reduced and restricted to the men whom these cliques choose to admit. They pretend to desire students who will not follow the example of intensive commercialism given them by the schools, and improvement of the caliber of the medical graduate. This is belied by the basis of choice of students. Two of the most important considerations are wealth and social position and Arianism. The non-Aryan quota system has rapidly degenerated into a method of blackmailing the Jewish applicants to the average tune of $1,000 for admission in many institutions. And in due time, this easy money racket has been extended to all applicants for admission. The restriction of medical education to rich, quote, gentlemen of leisure, unquote, usually spells no good for the average public. The law and medical education. The bosses of medicine collaborated with the AMA and established minimum standards and requirements for medical schools, which were never successively incorporated into the law of the various states. Under these laws, they appointed themselves, or had themselves appointed, the dictators of medical education and licensure in their respective states. They invariably arranged to have the medical schools in which they had vested interests included in the list of legitimate institutions. But this does not mean to say that their schools made any attempt to comply with the minimum requirements which they set up in the law. Thus, as late as 1917, the College of Physicians and Surgeons, Columbia University, a school rated high in the Flexner Report, failed utterly to teach at least two subjects required by the Medical Practice Act of the State of New York. But its dean, Dr. Samuel Lambert, was a member of the Medical Board of Regents, who controlled medical education in the state of New York. I recall with excellent reason the caliber of instruction which students received in that school. The most illustrative incident occurred in my senior year at the school. My section of the class was assigned for quote-unquote instruction in surgery to the Presbyterian Hospital. Our instructor was a fellow of the American College of Surgeons, a man more distinguished for his social and financial affiliations than for his competence as a surgeon. Without the former, he would have been quickly denied the opportunity to operate as an incompetent. He has his incompetence and his social and financial position to thank for the fact that he was kicked upstairs and made the executive head of a surgical department. Our instruction consisted in watching him operate. It was barbarous. Three patients died on the operating table under his knife in one session because of egregious blunders and gross carelessness. I dreaded to think that life could be sacrificed so cold-bloodedly to such absolute and unbelievable incompetence. Reassigned to the same instructor on the following day, I sat with fellow members of the section in a room reserved for students that was separated by a partition from the hospital library. We guardedly voiced our opinions and our horror at the deaths we had witnessed on the previous day and speculated on the possibility of a repetition of the incident. Before long, a patient passed on the way to the operating room, the first victim of the day. When he had passed, I remarked to my fellow students, "More sheep to the slaughter." Much to our embarrassment, the instructor in question bounded out of the adjoining library room and disappeared. A few minutes later, I was summoned to the office of the superintendent of the hospital. The instructor had accused me of making the above-stated remark to the patient. I was suspended and ordered to report to Dean Lambert. This was within 2 weeks of graduation. On reporting to the dean, he informed me that I was suspended and would not be permitted to take the examinations or to graduate. I heatedly challenged his statement. He thereupon pronounced me to be mad. Fearing little whatever truth there may have been to his remark, I offered to submit that question to a competent psychiatrist of his own choosing. Fortunately, the psychiatrist let me off. I passed my examinations with flying colors, and even received an offer of an appointment in the Department of Neurology and Psychiatry. Thus ended my first tilt with organized medicine and the hospital system. Upon passing my state board examinations, I bethought myself of the deficiencies of the medical education which I had survived. I notified the State Board of Medical Regents of the failure of my alma mater to comply with the Medical Education Act. Shortly thereafter, Dr. Lambert was no longer dean or regent. The caliber of the control of medical education is made even more apparent by a recent incident involving the New York State Board of Medical Regents. Its secretary, Dr. Harold Rippins, was named in connection with quote-unquote fixing for a highly organized abortion racket. He died of angina pectoris in the home of an assistant attorney general assigned to the board who was also accused. In the hands of men of this type lies the control of medical education, licensing, and quote-unquote ethics in all sections of the country. Quote-unquote rising standards of medical education. The monopoly of medical education has not resulted in any material improvement in caliber or mode of instruction. It is motivated by the same objective, the building up of large teaching incomes and lucrative consulting practices for the professors and instructors. It is unfortunate that the privileges and advantages of teaching medicine in the medical schools and universities is, as frequently as not, a matter of nepotism or of outright purchase. And it is relatively seldom dependent upon superior ability or superior knowledge of the subject taught. The subdivision of medical and surgical teaching into narrow specialties facilitates the distribution of the personal advantages which might be derived from the medical schools among a larger group of favored sons. The caliber of teachers in some phases of medicine is inconceivably low. Some subjects, such as otology, the study of diseases of the ear, require knowledge of the sciences. It is doubtful if there are more than a half dozen professors of otology in the universities of the country who have sufficient basic training in the physical sciences to understand the subjects which they are supposed to teach. The present-day medical school differs little from the proprietary and commercial medical school of the earlier days. Nowadays, there is a bit more individual instruction and practical experience in diagnosing and treating of patients. There has recently been added to the medical course in most states a fifth year devoted to internship. Internship in a large hospital does not imply effective instruction in the art of medicine. The greater part of the intern year is spent by the student in the mechanical routine of a large hospital. The larger the hospital, the more effectively is the intern reduced to the role of a cog in a machine. For the privilege of doing the servile tasks of the hospitals, interns are now compelled to pay high tuition fees into the coffers of medical schools. Objectives of modern medical education. The prime objectives of medical education and the mode of instruction in the present-day monopolistic medical schools remain essentially the same as they were in the days when the schools were frankly commercial. The student is not taught so much that he will not be forced to call his instructor into consultation when he graduates and enters practice. Mass classroom instruction, which must be set at the pace of the mediocre student, helps to ensure against effective instruction. The subdivision of medicine into specialties involves the endless repetition of elementary and readily learned ideas and consumes the time which might be spent in acquiring a rounded knowledge. Lectures by the hour are given by professors and instructors who are too busy with their medical practices to keep abreast of advances in medicine. These lectures are often of very low quality and are generally extremely fragmentary. They merely rob the student of the time that might be devoted to mastering his subject and to acquiring skill in its application. Many essential phases of medicine consigned to the realm of specialties and post-graduation instruction are glossed over and neglected in the training of the medical student. But neglect of these subjects ensures that the medical graduate will be compelled to refer cases of the diseases which have not been taught him to the specialist professor or instructor. This was stressed by Dr. James Roland Engel, president of Yale University, in a recent address made at the installation of President Dr. Frank C. Babbitt of the Long Island College of Medicine. He said, quote, "I am convinced that the present curriculum of many of our medical schools is staggering under a useless legacy of traditional subject matter, which could be curtailed to a great extent. Reorganization of medical courses would be a great improvement and would result in the saving of time and energy of the student and would materially increase his actual mastery of the practical problems with which he is later to be confronted. It might be necessary to establish a few new chairs, but the results would be worth the cost and trouble." Unquote. And that concludes part 15 of Your Life Is Their Toy from 1948 by Dr. Emmanuel Josephson.